So, good afternoon, everybody. This is the panel on Paris Accord, composers, performers, and the public. Let me briefly tell you what we're going to do on this panel. Paris Accord is a text and a process that started at a meeting in Paris in June, and James Love, who is going to speak first, will introduce us to the coalition of creative people and the public that came together around formulating a joint statement in a whole about a whole range of issues. And one of the issues concerns the compensation for music and music recordings, and that's going to be the focus of the panel. So the other speakers you will be hearing will speak about this issue, but first I would like to ask Jamie Love to introduce us to the Paris Accord process that he initiated. Please, Jamie.
Broadcast or anything,
but you're not projecting.
I'm fine.
No, it's okay.
Hello, I'm Jamie Love. I work in the United States in an organization actually that's an international organization that works in issues about we're the consumer project on technology. So we come out of the traditional consumer movement, although we've been drawn to a lot of issues about technology and computers and access to medicine and a variety of things. And during this time, the people within the consumer movement and a lot of civil rights groups and people that come from the free software movement and a variety of the constellation of these groups, we've been part of an effort to build stronger ties between these different movements that are concerned about access, and to make people more aware about the commonalities of some of the concerns they have about access to knowledge and access to knowledge goods, and I think that campaign has been progressing well. There's been a movement of groups and peoples to collaborate more, to see that the legitimacy of the demands that they make, and to be creative about proposals to address these issues. Another thing that's related to this is there's quite an interesting set of initiatives having to do with what some people refer to as business models, but is actually a bit broader than business models, but they're just new ways of thinking about the production of knowledge and knowledge goods. And the particular ones I think most of us have been interested in are the ones that relate to knowledge goods where the knowledge is sort of more or less maybe free in the margin or more accessible because of different pricing models or things like that. So there's this sort of movement on sort of new modes of production of knowledge and knowledge goods on the one hand, and then these sort of increasingly aspiration of people for ethical reasons, for practical reasons, for self-interested reasons to have more access. Now, at the same time, the usual complaint about access to medicine, access to scientific journals, access to music, access to all these different things is the issue of the livelihoods of the creative communities that create these goods, or the way that investors can be protected. And so there's this often in the debates, certainly on access, there's these seen as these competing ideas of the interest of the creative community that create works or inventions or things like that on the one hand, and the people that are the creative communities on the other. And in some fields, people are beginning to rethink whether there's a real conflict of interest, or whether or not you could realign the interest different. And people are rethinking the role of the intermediaries that sort of bind these two parties together, the people that do science, that make inventions, that perform music, that write music, that you know, and that sort of thing, on the one hand, or make films, and the people that want access to the works on the other. And they're beginning to rethink this, and within this exercise, the idea came out that would it be possible to more systematically think about a new political alignment between creative communities on the one hand and consumer interest on the other hand? I mean, why do we have to think of patients who need access to scientific discoveries as somehow pitted against the pharmaceutical industry in some kind of life and death tussle about things? So why do we have to think of things that way? Can't we more align the interest of the of the creative community, of artists with their fans, etc.? And so, so the idea came out that there would be this meeting in Paris that was held in June. And Paris was selected because Paris has this tradition of honoring authors and really a strong commitment to copyright and protecting creative communities. And the French often express this as not being about the publishers, which is, I think, more of a British or American tradition, but more about the authors themselves. And so we like the sort of symbolism of this tradition. And so the idea was to have a meeting, and we wanted to bring together these different strands. The strands were the medical research and development, software, what we call the public as creative community, which is this whole role of people being bloggers or doing different things themselves, where the public, as amateurs in some cases, are playing an important role. And then films, video, art, you know, filmmakers and the viewing public, recorded music, which is what we're going to talk about today, the interest of songwriters, performers, and the listening public, and then scholarly publishing and authors. So the basic architecture of the project was the development of an initial draft document, which was just an attempt to cobble together from various proposals and outlines of a possible negotiation or an agreement between the people on different sides that was broken to these different sections, which was presented in June, and then it was debated and criticized. And the idea, maybe too ambitious over the summer, was to have a new text for a high-level set of principles that apply to everything, and then to begin negotiations and very detailed recommendations in the particular areas, such as music or software or medicine, that would be longer appendixes. So we're actually running a little behind because summer vacations and other crazy things that it kind of took over, but the project is still alive and running, and we're very pleased today at this panel in Berlin to feature one of the, I think, most important elements of this conversation politically, which is the area of music, because many of the debates over the way that artists are their livelihoods are protected. So many people are questioning whether or not exclusive rights, digital rights management technology, and sort of police state approaches to music industry is really in the long-term interest of either the listeners or the music industry itself. And so the effort was to see if there's some contours of an agreement between the creative communities and performers in the music area on the one hand and the people who listen to music on the other hand about serve the interest of the both. So I'm going to actually let the panel speak for itself on the substantive areas and thank Volker very much for including us in this wonderful conference, the Wizards of OS. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you, Jamie, for being here, and all of you, of course. Jamie was also on the session on biotechnology, and also we will continue both of these panel discussions in a workshop on Sunday. First half on music compensation, second half continuing from the financing biotechnology innovation session. So now we will hear about three different approaches to music compensation. It's one attempt to answer one of the core questions of Wizards of Oz 4, how to make money with free bits. And we will hear about collective models. So collectives of creative people on the one side and sort of collective arrangements. I mean, you don't have to become a member of anything, but a pool of money collected from users and people who appreciate music on the other side. And I am very happy to introduce Peter Jenner, who is the Secretary General of the International Music Managers Forum. Peter is from London, so we will have two models presented from a copyright tradition background, and we will hear from one model from France, so from a droit d'auteur tradition, and I think that will also be an issue for the discussion later on. The differences that these different legal traditions make to the proposals that we're debating here. But first, Peter Jenner, please.
Hi. Jolly good, jolly interesting. I'm very pleased I didn't write anything before I came here, because I've been in a steep learning curve, because I'm a creature from a different time and place. I'm a casualty from the 60s, and I can hardly do anything on a computer but just about cope with my email. But I am a first-class bullshitter. And I think I have the great advantage of, because I don't know how they work, I can think about what they should be doing and how they could relate to our business. I can see what they do, I can see what they're meant to do to some extent, and I have some idea of how it might interrelate with an industry I've been involved with for 40 years. I started as a manager of the Pink Floyd in 1966, so I've seen almost the whole rise and fall of the British record industry. I saw the album underground music, album boom. Because the Floyd were the first band who had a deal with a major to make an album. I saw the album decline and the CD come up and replace it. And I now see the CD in decline and the new distribution coming up. I have, I think, as a result of that, a sort of a distance, a view of the, how a historical view. I'm a living historical monument. I hope I'm living. And I also have the disadvantage that perhaps that I represent the top end of the music industry. I have to say that although I am the chairman of the International Music Managers Forum, I'm an extremely bad chairman, and I don't bother to clear what I think with all the members of my body. So you have to say that I am trying to persuade people of all sorts and in all sorts of areas of the wisdom of my thoughts, and they don't necessarily reflect on what the other managers throughout the industry think. I suspect that what I'm thinking is not impossible for most managers to accept in some way or another. I also have to say that I'm not a cultist. I don't have any ideological commitment to any particular business models. I have to say I was shocked at seeing the aggravation up in that thing with that panel, with not the panel, the workshop with Lawrence Lessig. It was like going into a, it was like being eavesdropping in a Marxist, in a Trotskyist meeting. It was terrifying, and thank God I don't have to deal with that sort of thing. It was all about, good God, it was like sort of Mormons and things. So anyway, let's hope. You can see that I'm a man of many prejudices. Where am I coming at all this? I'm seeing that what's happening is that the essential nature of the industry is changing. That's obvious, that's banal, but it's a very fundamental change. You can see that what has happened in the industry and historically is that there was a technology that led to the development of a business, which led to the development of a legal structure, which was called, we call in short terms, the copyright business, which in turn determined how the industry developed, which determined how the business developed, which determined how the copyright developed, which determined how the technology developed. And all this was a sort of a circle which kept bombing along from, certainly the whole of the 20th century. in all those technologies, it was all about manufacturing bits of plastic or bits of something and shifting something from somewhere to somewhere else and people buying something with some music stuck on the top of it. And so it just was a question of how did the music get onto the bit of whatever it was, and how did it get from there to there? And what happened through the 20th century is that it became more and more efficient. It became bigger and bigger units. It became more and more internationalized. But it was still essentially the same business. The CD was the same, really, as the original sort of music roll. And in a similar way that the phonograph was developed, the records were developed by the manufacturers of the hardware. They invented the record machines, and they thought, oh, my God, we better have something to put on your phonographs. You know, you've got your thing with the big horn and, you know, the dog and all that stuff. And then you had to have something on it. So that was all the early record companies were hardware manufacturers, and they were just making stuff to put on those machines. There was important decisions in America in the 20s which separated that relationship between the record makers and the hardware, from which the whole of the development of the record business happened. It was the to do with the copyright and patents and all that sort of business. So it's always been a big problem in the industry, and patents and copyrights have had a lot to do with how the industry develops and the sort of way in which it developed quickly or slowly. And I think that one of the great things was that both the compact cassette and the CD were essentially open formats. I mean, I'm sure that's not the right word, but, you know, you could, for a fairly small license fee, anyone could make a CD, anyone could make a compact cassette. They were very open in that sense. I know there's commercial, you know, you had to pay Sony Philips for those things. So when we come into the digital world, we're now in a world where instead of having to get the music so that you could play it at home from a piece of plastic which was manufactured in a factory in a sort of mass production model, you're able to manufacture it at home. You know, instead of having to put it onto a truck or a train and ship it around and ship it back to a warehouse, it can just be put onto a server and off it goes, a load of bits. I mean, I think this really fundamentally changes the structure of the industry in a way that the industry doesn't like. It removes the control of the distribution, which has been the heart of the business of the record companies. The dominance of the record companies has been built around their control of the manufacture and distribution. And from that, and because of that, they've been able to acquire the content to put it, to send through. If you wanted to get paid and you wanted to get your records in shops all around the world, you more or less had to be signed up by one of the major labels. And that was what their business was. It was the control of the distribution. And they spotted very early on that the internet and the electronic distribution was a threat to that control of the distribution. And if you want to look at why have they been doing what they've been doing, the only rational explanation is to say that they have been doing it really to protect their monopoly distribution practices around the world. And incidentally, and I think it's something that it also is to do with how they've structured their contracts. The record companies have incredibly tight contracts which were developed for rewarding or reflecting the relationship between the creator and the manufacturer in a hard carrier market. So there's extremely detailed descriptions in most contracts about what you would get for a 7-inch record, a 12-inch record, a CD, whether it's sold in the UK, whether it was sold in America, whether it was sold in France, whether it was sold to soldiers in an army distribution center, whether it was sold through mail order, whether it was sold in a premium package, and so on and so on and so on. It was an extremely detailed, complicated contract. It never talked about electronic distribution. And so there is a real underlying shakiness in their contractual position, which I think they all whistle and pretend there's no problem. But I think, and I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that it's unquestionably the case that when you've defined all the sort of ways in which you get paid in a very tight way, and there's an entirely different way of doing it, you at least have a problem as to how you should pay your artists, how you should pay the authors. This is where a lot of the problems lie. So you've got the internet challenges the record companies in two very, very crucial ways. And that's why they've been fighting, and that's why they've been in the front line of the argument. Underneath that, at the next level down, there's also the question that if they're not doing the manufacturing and distribution, and if the individual at home is buying the distribution by buying the broadband connection and buying the computer which can receive the bits, and they're buying a burner so that they can make the records, then who is doing the distribution and who is doing the manufacturing? Again, I think it raises very fundamental problems for them. It seems to me, but it's interestingly, it's not entirely unrelated to what happened with music publishers. Music publishers in the 50s, and it was dying, that sort of way of music publishing, when I came into the business in the mid-60s. But by then it was dying. But before then, music publishers were essentially a bunch of people who printed sheet music. They printed sheet music, they distributed it to shops which sold sheet music to people who then bought the sheet music and they played it in clubs and pubs and dance halls. They sold arrangements. They sold arrangements of those songs and all the rest of it. They went out and they took their songs to singers and persuaded singers to sing those songs at concerts or on records and so on. Somewhere in the middle of the 60s, or in this between the mid-50s and the mid-60s, they realized that the real money was actually in the way that they licensed the recordings, they licensed recordings and in public performance. So you have, on the one hand, you have records. On the other hand, you have public performance. Public performance is whether it's played in a disco, whether it's played in a cafe, whether it's played, most importantly, on the radio. For this, there is streams of income. This income is split between the writers and the performers. And around that split, there are institutions that have been built. When you sell a record, again, there's a split. There's something obviously for the retailers, the distributors, and there's something for the guy who made the record, or the girls, or whoever made the record, and something for the people who wrote the music. Sometimes, but not, by no means always, the same people. So you've got, in all these cases, you've got structures, institutional structures, which are built around a distinction between performance and mechanical, between authors and performers. That distinction does not make any sense on the internet. Every mechanical has a performance, and every performance has a mechanical, or might have a mechanical. In other words, there may be a copy that is going to be made, and maybe people are just, when they're peer-to-peering, they're just listening to music. They're not buying it. This whole argument that is clearly nonsense, that every record, every piece of music that anyone has downloaded from the net is a replacement sale. I would say it's a replacement. It's a more, in many cases, it's a more fluid, self-selected radio. In other words, they're just listening to a song. But it's not within the whole legal and technical structures. It doesn't fit. It's not that within those structures. So there's this absolute nightmare of rights. And each of those rights is administered by different societies or different legal structures, both, different legal structures and different societies in every country, all working under different rules. So on top of this, this problem, the first problem, you've now got three problems. You've got an industry, we've got a distribution system which goes cross borders, as well as having the problem that you're muddling up the performance and the mechanical in a way that's very hard to distinguish between. as well as getting rid of the distribution and manufacturing function. This is obviously very similar to the sort of problem that stagecoaches had when they saw the trains coming across the prairies towards them in America in the late 18th, 19th century. Clearly, stagecoaches did not survive. And I think that clearly the old record business, as we've known it, is not going to survive. However, I'm not an absolutist. As I told you, I'm a pragmatist. I think there will be some form of hard carriers. I think there will be some sort of business going on. And most importantly, I think we have to find a way to pay the people to make the recorded music. I think that the alternative notion that it all is just free is absolute nonsense. It's sort of free in the distribution sense, and it's sort of free in the manufacturing sense because, you know, the whole internet thing is about swapping files. That's what it does. It swaps files. And, you know, music can be reduced to files, and away we go, swapping hippity happily hobbly. Everyone's happy. But the problem is, how does the artist get paid? How do you make a living? Because there's a whole loads of us who are directly or indirectly making a living from recorded music. I'm one of those who's made a living indirectly from recorded music because I'm what I call a... I live off other people. I live off immoral earnings. I take artists' money off them for trying to perform a function, to try and increase their income, and then taking a lot of it off them. So that's what I do, and there's a lot of us doing that. There's a whole range of people living off that industry of, you know, the traditional music business. So I think that we have to go back to very much into first principles. I think I'm always very pleased when I hear Larry Lessig, because he always says he believes in copyright. I absolutely believe in copyright because it provides a stable income source for creators. It provides a security to permit investment in creation. It provides a sort of a more predictable flow. It provides a way of promoting. I mean, I really resent the idea that artists shouldn't make any money from their recordings and they should just go and do gigs, because some people don't do gigs. Also, you can only do concerts, you know, in your own local area unless you've got some people know you further afield. You've got to get the word out. And how we get the word out is through recorded music. That's how you pass the word to your friends. Oh, have you heard this new artist? You know, I saw them at a concert. They were great. And here's a copy of their record. You know, here's an MP3 file. It's the same thing. It's the same function. You're passing on some of that music. I heard it on the radio. I've heard this new act on the radio. That is another way that you pass the knowledge of the artist. It's the way that we build up our cultural diversity. It's the way that we can know more about music than just the people who happen to have walked into the pub in which we're sitting and to have strummed a guitar or sung a song at the piano. So, I'm already rambling off. So anyway, copyright, I think, is about consumers and creators. But it's been hijacked by the intermediaries. To me, the justification for copyright is that it provides a way to facilitate the provision of more choice and more music for the consumer, and at the same time provides a reward for the creator. And that everybody in between, which includes the record companies, the music publishers, the managers, the agents, have to justify their existence in the new world, as far as I'm concerned, by how they can facilitate that relationship in the new economy. And I think it's very interesting to think about what the sort of the new economy might involve. I mean, I think the new economy offers all sorts of opportunities. I think it offers the possibility of all the ideas of viral marketing and networks and groups of people communicating with each other and developing national, local, international common interests. And in that sort of situation, I'm of the feeling that we are in a position where we're moving from an era of mass marketing to an era of massive niche markets. If I want to sell a record or a recording or an artist in the future, I'm going to probably be looking not to become a general pop star and get played on the radio, which is a mass market. I'm going to be looking at particular websites and particular community groups who are interested in a particular type of music. So, for instance, I think there's enormous possibilities for world music in this context. I think there's enormous possibilities for all sorts of minority music. So that, for instance, if you're a speed metal band from Norway, you're going to get known about in Germany, not because you're heard on the radio, not because it's written about in the big newspapers or the big magazines, but because it's on the speed metal websites in Germany. And it's quite clear that these networks are already going in the sort of underground music world. I think that they will develop in the world music area and in all sorts of other things, like with increased mobility. The demand for Slovenian music in Germany is probably very small, except from Slovenians. I bet there are probably, I don't know, something like 50,000, 100,000 Slovenians living in Germany. And they probably, half of those have got some form of internet connection. And probably half of those, in turn, would like to hear Slovenian music. At the moment, there's no way they can get it unless people happen to send them records from home, or their friends send them sort of, send them some peer-to-peer things, some things. So we have different marketing possibilities. And it becomes, I think, a marketing which is driven not so much by cash, but by enthusiasm and by community. I think we also have a change in cost structures which demand changing business models. So it seems to me it's impossible to justify the sort of bite of the cake that the traditional record companies have taken. So that as far as that crucial element, as far as the stock exchange is concerned, which is their margin is going to crash. There is no way on earth that the record companies are going to maintain their margins, because the price is going to come down. There's no way that a distribution where the marginal cost is virtually zero is going to manage to maintain a sort of €1 per 3 minute track model. It ain't going to last. And it's shown that it's not going to last by the problems that iTunes now have. iTunes, which is the great success story, iTunes is no longer growing. Its downloads are not growing. They're fairly static. They may be growing up a little bit, down a little bit, but they're not growing. The iPod's still selling, but I heard on the television the other day that the Mr. iPod, or Mr. European iPod, bragging when he was launching his new iPod where you can get your Disney movies, thanks to whatever his name, Jobs, that they've sold 60 million iPods. And those 60 million iPods have 1.5 billion iTunes on them. How many iTunes is it? The mathematics tells me that's somewhere underneath 30 downloads per iPod. This doesn't look like a good business to the people who are making the records. It looks like a bloody awful business. And I think that's why the record companies are beginning to panic. I think there is hope on the way. The record companies can see that, on the one hand, in America, sales in the first quarter this year, I think, went down by some, I'm told, by about 25% or more. 25%. This isn't a slight decline. This is a nosedive. This is a catastrophe. iTunes is no way going to pick up the slack. So, moving very rapidly on, because I've probably only got 1 minute, my answer, what is my solution? And we will talk a lot more about this tomorrow, so to be continued at another time in another place. But the basic idea is, I think, is to suggest that what is required is that everybody should pay a little bit every month for music, and then they can do what the hell they like with it. So that, if you're paying... And here I have what I call my magic figures. And I should have a slide and a PowerPoint looking really good. But basically, I can only deal in fairly simple mathematics. It's part of my age problem. Is if you paid $60 a year for all the music, $50 a year for all the music, and there were 600 million subscribers, $50 a year, That's like $5 a month. And you can have all the music that's available. And you can do what the hell you like with it. You can send it to your friends. You can burn it. You can listen to it. You can dance naked in the bathroom with it. It doesn't matter. We don't care what you do with it. You pay your $5. You pay your $5, 600 million subscribers worldwide, and we have the current size of the record business over the counter. That's retail sales. That's after all that business with manufacturing and shipping it and selling it and all the whole thing, the whole game. Now, that seems to me is a model which says, that looks good. That looks very good. And if you then think on top of that, that if you had that situation, there would probably be, within very short time, something like 20 billion tracks available. Maybe 200 billion. Who knows? Bloody lot. All those Brazilian bands we heard about yesterday, if you were here, you know, with the 400 CDs a year, they would all be on there, you know. And so then you're going to have to pay for someone to sift it all out. Another great business for the record companies, because you're going to be, if you really like your music and you've got your cash rich and time poor, you're going to pay for people to select it for you and sort it out for you and make it better. You're going to pay for a service which provides you with super duper quality as opposed to, you know, as it comes quality. So I think there's a whole possibility of a new sort of record industry, which on the one hand permits much easier entry so that anyone can bring their music in, and that which also permits far greater diversity, but which also permits the record companies to make far more money if they can get to grips with it. And interestingly, there are signs that they are beginning to get to grips with it, because their old tactic of just merging and merging and merging, it's all started to looking a bit funny with the Sony BMG thing in the EU. We don't know quite where that's going, but at least that was a sort of warning signal that, you know, they can't actually get to the Melodia situation, which was clearly what they were after. The Melodia model was clearly the ideal model. I remember coming back from a visit to Russia back in the Soviet days and going to visit the American label and with Billy Bragg, whom I manage, and we went in and said, oh, we've seen this great thing, you'd love this, you should see that, you've got a lot to learn from the Russians, you know. I said, what? He said, well, they've got one record company. They've got one record company, and they put out about 3 albums a month, and they all sell out. They make 20 million of them, and they all get sold in days, and there's about 5 of them running this record company. It's great. They all know what's going to happen. However many records they make, they sell them. I think they must have listened to us, because that seems to me what they were all trying to do. And I think that, you know, they ought to try and get it together. That might still save their bacon. I think there will be, so another couple of flashes. I think CDs or something like CDs will survive. I think they'll become very much more expensive, because I think listening to music is a very complex system thing. It's not just about the noise. It's about what it says about you. We all wear trousers, us chaps, and a lot of the girls as well, but we all wear trousers, and we choose what trousers we wear. We don't all wear the same trousers. And when we buy trousers, we are making a statement about ourselves. If I come in a smart suit, I'm saying I'm a smart businessman who has a smart suit. When I come in with me ratty old jeans, I'm saying I'm groovy, I'm young, I'm happening, I may be 63, but really I'm down with the kids. These signals are really important. When you buy a record, you wander around with a record, and what record you carry around with you or you put on your desk or you have on your racks is telling people the sort of person you are. So I think there will be a market for records. I think there'll be a much lower market for records, and I think they'll be much better packaged, and I think they'll be a lot more expensive. But I'm probably wrong, and we'll talk more tomorrow.
Thank you, Peter, for this wonderful way of setting out the landscape of music for us. The next speaker is going to be Bennett Linkhoff. So we have We are looking at this from different perspectives. We have the consumer's perspective. We just heard from Peter from a perspective of someone who earns money off of creative music works. Bennett Linkhoff has been working for ASCAP. So now we are getting not an inside perspective from a collecting society, because he is not working for ASCAP anymore, but is now an attorney at law in New York. But in this debate on levy-based solutions to file sharing, to music exchanges on the internet, to free bits, music free bits, he had a very early proposal from 2001 on the digital transmission right. And he has been working on this model, of course, and for The Wizards of Oz has been revising the model again. And we will hear about this model now. Please, Bennett Linkhoff.
Thank you, Volker. The other day, during a break between panels, I was speaking with a newly met colleague here who indicated surprise that someone with my prior work affiliation would be participating in this conference. I told him then, as I tell you now, this is an instance where things are different than they appear. I am, at worst, a sheep in wolf's clothing. It is not news to report that the digital music marketplace is in crisis. I believe that the situation is largely the making of the music industry itself. It results from the industry's failure to respond in appropriate ways to the changed circumstances imposed on it by emergence of global broadband communications. I would like to suggest a specific, detailed solution. My proposal relies entirely on free market mechanisms and fully voluntary collective rights administration, and if implemented, would maximize the lawful and licensed availability of recorded music for digital transmissions. I begin with this. The internet is fundamentally incompatible with a sales-based revenue model for works of popular culture, especially music. Prior to the internet, large-scale piracy of physical products such as records, tapes, and CDs was cumbersome at best and vulnerable at every turn to the industry's anti-piracy campaigns. Also in the past, the copying and distribution of music by individual consumers, while troubling, never imperiled the industry. Today, piracy of music files is cheap, quick, and easy. Internet transmissions are instantaneous and worldwide in origin and reach. Every internet user, whether or not involved in peer-to-peer file sharing, and every webcaster or other digital audio service provider in the world is a potential source of unauthorized mass distribution of recorded music. Through the internet, the market for sale of individual recordings can be ruined in a moment's time and without payment of any royalties to songwriters, music publishers, recording artists, or record labels. Given this, the industry's traditional sales-based revenue model, based as it is on the sale of hit recordings, is no longer sustainable. Neither law, nor technology, nor moral suasion will change this result. Unfortunately, the music industry has failed to undertake the transformation needed to meet these new circumstances. Instead, it has sought to preserve the established relationships upon which its past successes were based, and to extend its sales-based revenue model into the digital age. To these ends, it has followed a multi-part strategy. For example, it has experimented with a variety of access restrictions and anti-copying measures. But all of these have engendered effective countermeasures, and news of the successful hack was quickly known by everyone who cared. There is no reason to believe that the result will be different next time or ever, and this despite that acts of circumvention are illegal. Moreover, copyright-friendly audio players may raise fair use and free speech concerns, depending on whether and how they impede individuals from communicating with each other. Besides, Consumers want devices that accept all works and recordings that play on all devices. They want to enjoy music when, where, and how they themselves decide. The industry has also pursued legislation banning hardware and software that might undermine the sales-based revenue model by inducing infringement. This has slowed the telecommunications providers in deployment of high-speed broadband connections for the consumer market and blocked consumer electronics makers and technology firms from offering new products with next-generation capabilities. The industry now seeks to banish MP3 technology altogether by prohibiting its use by webcasters who wish to avail themselves of the statutory license in the United States for digital transmissions of sound recordings. In addition, the industry refuses to authorize services that offer consumers full, unfettered, DRM-free access to music. To be sure, it does support services that offer DRM-encumbered music files, files that are tethered to particular playback devices, files that time out, are only available while the consumer remains a subscriber of the service from which the music was obtained, or other use restrictions. These are, at best, alternatives to the services that consumers want, but not substitutes for them. And because these licensing schemes fall short of meeting consumer demand, they leave the sales-based revenue model vulnerable to widespread infringement by consumers who refuse to accept less than they already know they can have. The industry has already warned that licensed music sales destinations such as iTunes and its competitors cannot thrive if unlicensed sources of music continue to operate. By its refusal to meet consumer demand, the industry has relegated consumers to black market services where adware, spyware, pornography, and privacy violations abound. And, of course, the industry has launched a campaign of infringement litigation against those same consumers, seeking ruinous damages and imposition of criminal penalties for conduct occurring in the privacy of people's homes. Another element of the industry strategy to salvage its legacy business model is imposition of unprecedented program content restrictions on webcasters. The industry fears that webcasting will allow consumers to make unauthorized copies of recordings if they know or are reasonably able to anticipate when particular recordings will be streamed. Accordingly, in the United States by statute and in Europe by contract, webcasters may not offer interactive programming by which consumers can request the particular recordings be transmitted, may not offer programming dedicated to particular artists or even containing more than a few songs by the same artist or from the same recording, may not make prior announcements of the recordings they will stream, and may not offer archive programs shorter than 5 hours duration. This interference in the programming decisions of webcasters has no counterpart in the music industry's relationships with broadcast, cable, and satellite program services. It diminishes webcasting unnecessarily, rendering it far less compelling for consumers than ordinary broadcast radio. And finally, in two especially egregious instances of overreaching, public performance and mechanical rights licensing organizations demand double payments where only a single transmission of a work is involved. For example, both a mechanical and a public performance license fee is charged even if the music was transmitted only for downloading and was not audible while being sent. And both fees are also charged even where the only copies made are transitory and incidental to transmissions that are nothing more than performances, such as in on-demand streaming. The market forces at work at the intersection of copyright and the internet are wildly asymmetrical and to the disadvantage of music industry rights holders. Thus, despite the industry's efforts, the unauthorized distribution of recorded music continues unabated. Peer-to-peer file-sharing networks proliferate, and new means of mass distribution have arisen. If anything, the industry's efforts have resulted in fewer licensed transmissions, of fewer recordings, and slowed the growth of royalties that songwriters, music publishers, recording artists, and record labels otherwise may have earned. In my view, public policy should strongly support the opportunity of music industry rights holders to derive ample rewards from their contributions to culture and commerce. However, by the same token, the music industry has no right to demand that public policy support its desire to do business in a particular way. The problem lies with the industry's addiction to the sales-based revenue model. As long as its fortunes are tied to sales, it must continue both punitive litigation against consumers and interference in the free markets for technology, consumer electronics, and telecommunications services. What is needed is an alternative to the sales-based revenue model for musical works and sound recordings, an approach to rights licensing and rights management that does not depend on the efficacy of exclusionary technologies for its success, a solution that simultaneously protects the integrity of copyright, promotes technological innovation, facilitates all manner of digital audio services, and meets consumer demand. Remarkably, two changes only are needed to bring about these salutary results. Both are necessary, and neither alone is sufficient. The first change is this. The rights of songwriters, music publishers, recording artists, and record labels in their respective works should be aggregated so as to create a single, unified digital transmission right for sound recordings and for the musical works embodied in them. The new right would replace the party's now existing reproduction, public performance, and distribution rights, and in Europe, the communication or making available rights. These would no longer have separate and independent existence for purposes of digital transmissions. The new right would extend to all acts involved in digital transmissions of recorded music to end users and would be enforceable against all those directly involved in such transmissions. Webcasters and other digital audio service providers, whether they offer streaming, downloading, or both, would need a license. So too would operators of centralized P2P networks. Individuals who participate in decentralized networks would be responsible for securing their own licenses for their P2P activities, as would those who engage in, for example, podcasting. On the other hand, software developers, technology firms, and telecommunications and internet service providers, as such, would have no liability. Under the digital transmission right, it would no longer matter whether end users only listened to transmissions or also downloaded them, how many copies, if any, were made in the course of transmissions, whether transmitted copies were stored on a temporary or on a permanent basis, or whether works were used on one audio playback device or another. The digital transmission right would not depend on access restrictions and anti-copying technology for its success, nor would it require continued suppression of free markets for technology and consumer electronics. Rather than limiting access to music, rights holders would have the incentive to encourage the most extensive uses possible. This would free the industry from pursuit of unbreakable technological measures, allowing it to focus instead on development of effective monitoring techniques to support royalty distribution. A digital transmission right would be impervious to copyright infringement. Unlike the reproduction and distribution rights that underlie the sales-based revenue model, but like the public performance right, the digital transmission right cannot be subverted by one or more unlicensed audio services, webcasters, peer-to-peer networks, or the like. Whether or not particular transmissions are licensed would not affect the market for the digital transmission right overall. This is proven by the experience of ASCAP and BMI in the United States and their sister organizations around the world with the licensing of over-the-air broadcast radio stations. The license fees collected from these broadcasters constitute a major portion of ASCAP and BMI's annual revenue. However, even if the largest radio station or group of stations were not licensed at a particular time, the rights organization's ability to license the thousands of other broadcasters in the United States would not be impaired. Despite infringement by the few, the overwhelming majority of broadcasters continue to operate lawfully by securing the public performance licenses they need. Those who act outside the law can and should be sued for copyright infringement. So too would it be with a digital transmission right. If the music industry made licenses available, the overwhelming majority of those whose transmissions of music would require authorization, service providers, and individuals alike, would pay the fees that are due. The question remains, however, how to administer this new right. I favor voluntary collective licensing. Of the rights that the digital transmission right would replace, only the record label's right to sell recordings is not already administered to one degree or another by one or another collective. There are hundreds of thousands of copyrighted songs and recordings, and tens of thousands of music industry rights holders. In the absence of collective licensing, multiple licenses on inconsistent terms, including the obligation to employ possibly incompatible DRM regimes, would likely be required for each work that is to be digitally transmitted. Collective licensing organizations act on behalf of all of their own rights holder members, as well as on behalf of the members of affiliated sister organizations in other territories, to offer those whose uses of music require authorization a one-stop shop for their licensing needs. In my view, the administration of music rights is better served by larger and fewer collectives. And for the purpose of administering the digital transmission right, a single collective in each territory that is well-run, fully transparent, and accountable would be best. The collective would standardize license fee calculations and reporting and payment requirements. It would also standardize the DRM employed for identifying works and tracking them when they are transmitted. This data is needed to support royalty distribution. I believe that because they can be, royalties should be based on a census of licensed transmissions. Only in this way is it possible to assure that all rights holders, large and small, receive that share of royalties that is proportionate to the license fees paid for transmissions of their works. The current practice is to base royalties on sampling, which, however sophisticated, leaves rights holders uncompensated for many uses of their works, and almost certainly will miss those in the long tail altogether. I also believe that each of the four groups of music rights holders should be allocated a 25% share of the total royalties earned from digital transmissions of their works. In this way, singer-songwriters would receive 50% of all royalties earned from those works to which they made the overwhelmingly greatest contribution. Rights in music are owned locally, but through the internet, they are exploited in transmissions that cross national boundaries. Because of this, collectives and rights holders in more than one territory may claim an interest in the same transmission. This raises additional considerations for licensing and royalty distribution. I believe that license fees for transborder transmissions should be based either on the rates prevailing in the territory from which the transmission originates, or that of the collective issuing the license. If, as is the current practice, rates in the territory of reception are used, service providers who do not control where their transmissions are received would be unable to develop well-informed business strategies because unable to predict their music license fee costs. For royalty distribution purposes, transborder transmissions should be treated as if occurring both in the territory from which they are sent and the territory in which received. If rights holder interests are owned by different parties in the two territories, then those in each territory should receive one half of the available royalties. I see no reason why, in the internet context, Any one member of the four rights holder groups should be permitted to act as gatekeeper of the rights of all, with sole discretion to determine if, when, how, and by whom the digital transmission right may be exploited. Accordingly, the second change I suggest is this. Each songwriter, music publisher, recording artist, and record label should be treated as a co-owner of the digital transmission right in the recordings to which they contribute. And each should have the full and independent authority to grant non-exclusive licenses for digital transmissions of their recordings on any terms that they and their licensees find to be mutually acceptable. The only limitation on this right would be the obligation to account to their co-owners for any license fees earned. And if any rights holder of a particular work were to join the voluntary collective, then non-exclusive licenses for digital transmissions of that work, together with all other works in the collective's catalog, would also be available as part of a single license agreement from the collective. This system favors rights holders who participate in the collective licensing enterprise. But unlike the practice among European collectives today, it also maintains their right to engage in direct licensing outside of the collective. It allows service providers who transmit many recordings to obtain access to what is essentially a worldwide catalog through a single license from the collective, and allows those who transmit fewer works to avoid the collective entirely, relying instead on direct licenses from the rights holders whose works the service provider wishes to transmit. The music industry is marked by long-standing divisions, particularly between music publishers and record labels, regarding ownership, valuation, and administration of the different rights each group controls. Songwriters and recording artists also have concerns regarding their relationships with music publishers and record labels that control the works they create. No doubt, these four groups will contest how the available royalties should be divided among and between them. But that conflict should not be used as a reason to delay implementation of needed change in the consumer-facing side of the music business. The industry's transition from a sales-based to a transmission-based revenue model will be disruptive. And therefore, I think some measure of financial assistance would be appropriate. I suggest that a temporary levy be imposed on consumer electronics, technology, and related products. Revenue from the levy should be used to establish and launch the collective. It could also be made available to offset some portion of the losses incurred by rights holders because of this unexpected change in their circumstances. A digital transmission right, administered as I have suggested, would represent a major shift in leverage and economics within the music industry. And it almost goes without saying that those rights holders and the organizations that represent them, who have enjoyed the strongest position historically, will likely be reluctant to embrace such an alternative. Nevertheless, implementation of a digital transmission right would enable transmissions of music to be made available from the largest number and widest array of licensed sources anytime, anywhere, to anyone with network access. This result would not only serve the interests of the music industry, but also those of all the other participants in the digital music marketplace. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Bennett. So the Paris Accord group, the Paris Accord has a model in another alliance, the Alliance Publique Artiste in France, a quite broad alliance that came together over such a levy-based compensation system called Licence Globale in France, the global license. And this license, this model has taken the most concrete form of all the models that have been discussed across the planet. It was actually passed in the French Parliament as an amendment to copyright reform. And it was this amendment was brought in by two members of Parliament, one from the Conservative Party and one from the Socialist Party. The Socialist Party member, Christian Paul, was originally invited for this panel, but unfortunately, at the very last moment, was not available. So I'm very grateful that at very short notice, only at the beginning of this week, Alexandre Grauer agreed to come and to tell us about this the social process in France and about the model that was passed in Parliament in December of last year. In the end, eventually it was rolled back, but for this very short moment, it was actually on the books of law in France. Alexandre is chairman of the Electronic Music Quartz Awards as well, and therefore also very active in promoting mostly digital music, as I understand.
Yes.
And he is a member and representative of the Alliance Publique Artiste. Please, Alexandre.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. So I write everything. I'm going to present myself because nobody knows about me, just one person here. He's French, that's why. So, okay, first of all, I wanted to thank you for welcoming here a member of Alliance Publique Artiste. So after, I will tell you when you can put the slide. Yeah.
Please.
So I'm going to introduce myself. I'm Alexandre Grauer, president and founder of Quartz Electronic Music Awards. Quartz is in fact a distribution and support program for creations. Thanks to an online exhibition of musical and audiovisual works along with public and global vote, which ends during a final ceremony at the Cirque d'Hiver Bouglion in Paris. So each year. This program, it's a switch, I think, here.
No? Switch on, yeah.
I have to switch on me? Because, is it good? Yeah, here. Yeah, if you can switch on the... No, I changed nothing. Okay, sure. No signal? You want the signal? There is a signal? You want the signal?
It was out.
Okay, so... Yeah, okay. So this program federates 2,500 music labels and a few thousand of artists. And I am proud to announce that we already awarded some artists under Creative Commons use licenses at Pierre Henry, Ermin Schmidt, Holger Tschukai, and Klaus Schulze side. So I mean Creative Commons as a guarantee of good quality too. So let's talk seriously now. Once upon a time, this is why Volker called me, there was the global license. The global license. Okay, so the slides will illustrate the story I'm going to tell you. And I'm here today to tell you this story. According to a good many of MPs, deputy, this has been one of the most exciting legislative fight of their mandate. And for us, cultural players, one of the most important. I said fight because it was a difficult one. And the aftermath it caused will last until a global pay solution is adopted for the three beneficiary colleges, which means composer, songwriters, the performers, and the producers. So for the distribution of the works in the non-merchant file in internet. So the license the global license concerning so the field of the non-merchant field of internet. The Alliance Public Performers was created thanks to impulse of the Spedidam and the Adami, two companies in charge of the performers' right management, the left part of online music. The Alliance gathers 16 structures representative of the cultural players, the civil society, and the union members of the show business. Among the most famous, we can name Adami Spedidam, so I told you that. The UNAF, really important, this National Union of Familial Associations, which gathers 800,000 families as members. La Ligue de l'Enseignement, a teaching association with more than 3 million members. And the Consumer Association UFC Que Choisir, with 1 million members of the BUC. We introduce an alternative, the only possible alternative to the repression established by the Royalties and Related Rights Law, which came into force last August the 1st, after being amended by the French Constitutional Council, which, as a matter of fact, destroyed all the progress we made while reinforcing the law's unenforceability. So you can see here all the legal precedents in France. The global license is an improvement, an idea derived from what expressed one member of the French Socialist Party, Christian Paul. It was named legal license, the first, but was not compatible with the international treaties. Once created and following a legal study, the Alliance has proposed the global license, mandatory at first and then optional. This time, the license was compatible with the international treaties. So, alone against the entire music industry, we were about to protect with a global solution the interest of the three beneficiary colleges. It is then that an MP with a persuasion opposed to Christian Paul is Alain Suguenot of the UMP, the French party headed by Nicolas Sarkozy, introduced a bill leading the global license, co-signed by 50 deputies from the majority against Nicolas Sarkozy. Very unexpectedly, an amendment has been approved by the French Parliament last December. From the balcony of the Parliament chamber, you are a witness to, we were, as simple citizen spectators, we could witness our detractors' privileges, the son of one of them working in the culture minister cabinet, another one being personally present in the chamber during the debate, someone from the SACEM, not a politician, but someone from a citizen. The non-stop comings and goings of the lobbyists in the parliament's corridors, lobbyists representing majors as well as big computer companies, which in the meantime had obviously provided a good many of the regions of the deputies, more or less opposed to the global license, with their equipment. Today, I want to point out the disrespect of the Republican institutions and an insulting permissivity. We won't also forget that after the approval of the Vivendi amendment, which forbid the edition but not the use of the P2P software, when they are obviously designed for illegal ends or applications. More than that, there is a technical screening by the emergency judge, that call in a juge en référé in French. I don't know in English if it's an emergency judge, a juge en référé. You don't know. So, of the software used for illegal applications, so technical screening of the softwares used for illegal applications, and this without considering the final destination of the software. So it's really, it's amazing. Furthermore, after the amendment was approved, The Vivendi lobbyist received the decoration from the hands of the Minister of European Affairs in France. The propaganda. The global license opponents use significant media means. After you will see what is the global license and you will understand why. They waste, therefore, millions of euros of royalties and public money while accusing the Alliance of having the will to put an end to the royalties and its management company, the SACEM, which is run by dinosaurs for me. With petitions signed by artists who have been dead for 10 years, or TV, radio debates, which content was already written, the public, the consumer, could only hear the voice of repression. Example, if you download or exchange songs, you are a cracker and you stop Madonna and all the artists you like from earning their living. As we invited all the detractors to be part around the tables, no one accepted this constructive invitation. No one. The only goal was to keep Caesar of the money generated by music industry. They wanted neither to hear nor accept what I will say to you. First, the global license concerned music. Mediat chronology makes the application of the global license on the cinema really difficult. But even though a technical solution could be fine. The global license is above all a license. It authorizes the exchange of the works put at everybody's disposal in the internet non-merchant field. The global license is global. The three colleges benefit of the distributions, composers, songwriters, performers, and producers. But that is not the case today. While the performers get nothing and the composer, songwriter, no much more, it legalized the cultural, it legalized the global license, legalizes the cultural folders exchange while giving responsibility to the exchangers. The global license doesn't compensate for a loss. And the study of the Alliance collected with UFC Que Choisir proved that the music exchange play a very positive role for the work's promotion. So this is some key dates for the global license. The beneficiaries receive as payment an uncontrollable consultation and duplicating of their works. My personal experience with 2,500 labels always confirmed this situation from now 5 years. Those who exchange well buy well in the electronic field. Electronic music, sorry. The global license applies to the internet, not merchant field. This is really important. Therefore, the money collected is additional to the traditional rights and not subtractive to them. In this context, it is imperative to let management companies each have the know-how, because it's really important to make the distribution. This know-how exists. The existing artist right management companies are the perfect ones for ensuring this distribution with the utmost transparency. The ADAMI and the SPEDIDAM, for example, members of the Alliance, are already legally enabled to manage the rights of 70,000 artists. 70,000. As for the distribution, the Alliance ordered studios to establish models to Big Champagne, for example. The most adapted model of giving the solution for a fair distribution will be, in fact, the combination of the analysis of the cache memory of the server and the analysis of the exchange made by the volunteer panel. And so the amount of exchanges of one work from one artist of one label would become a distribution measure for the royalties. Technical survey combined with human survey. Today, every distribution model has a weak point, the one of the global license too. But we must take into account that a distribution as much and in the best way as possible is always better than nothing at all, such as the measures and those who are under their heels are suggesting. It will be an estimation model opposed to the intrusive control system the music majors company want. What would be the fruits of the global license? An additional income, because it is additional and non-subtractive. This is really important. An estimate of 2.3 million euros of annual royalty, which means twice more than the private copy in France. 25% of this royalty by the law, it's by the law in France, are intended to support artists' training, festival album, festivals, album production, trips, tours, theater, and everything. In conclusion, the artists and the publishers are still earning nothing for these new uses of their works. Nowadays, the global license is a good idea for its opponents. Lately, Universal announced, and you know that well than me, that it will give free access to 50% of its catalog against 90 seconds of advertisement. Here, it is the real free in two manners, for the composers, songwriters, and also for the consumers, who won't find interest in this offer very long. Some little genius will certainly create software to filter these ads. Nobody rose up against this news, and the same people already get organized to contain the relative craze for the Creative Commons licenses in France, which will certainly destabilize the monopoly established by the SACEM on royalties in the following years. So I hope that my English is not so bad in what I wrote. Thank you very much. You understood the licence globale? Yes? It was clear? Thank you.
Of course, 20 minutes is way too little time to explain the licence globale in detail, and there are very strong, powerful studies on the legal feasibility that you mentioned by Professor Lucas. There is a technical feasibility study, and there are economic feasibility studies that are very worthwhile looking at in much more detail, and I hope on Sunday during the workshop we can discuss this in more detail. So Alexander mentioned UVC Choisir already, which is in fact member of the European umbrella organization BERC, the European Consumers Organization. So there are consumers and consumer organizations backing this kind of levy system, but the position of the consumers is not that clear on this issue. And I welcome Cornelia Kutterer, who is the senior legal advisor of BERC, to give us an overview of the discussion about this new approach to compensating music within the European consumer landscape. Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Volker. My name is Cornelia Kutterer. I work for the European Consumer Organization. The European Consumer Organization is an umbrella organization of around 40 members in 30 European countries. Among those is, for example, the Bundesverband der Verbraucherschutzzentralen and Stiftung Warentest, as well as UFC Choisir, a member of the Public Artist Alliance, which we heard about just now. From a very personal point of view, and I have to say a very personal point at the moment, I do believe that the Public Artist Alliance gives the right answer to further digitalization, addresses the challenges in the internet, because it gives a legal framework to P2P file sharing, which we haven't yet established in other ways. This legal framework basically consists of two points, which is one, the downloading side, and one, the uploading side. as you all know, uploadings of unauthorized copies is infringing the making available right under the Information Society Directive, the European Copyright Directive. As to the downloading of unauthorized files, that is not so clear. The music industry usually claims that this is illegal downloading. That depends how you define a private copy. And the Lucas study makes it clear that the downloading is a private copying act, which would then be remunerated according to the Information Society Directive. That is one part of the assumptions of that study of the feasibility of this Public Artist Alliance. Well, the bad thing, I guess, which I have to say, is that also this is a very exciting development in France. It has been rather unheard on a European level. And there are many, many reasons for that. Mainly because the key players in France, which have been lobbying against the Public Artist Alliance, against the global license system, are very, very active in Brussels too, and are very, very powerful as well in Brussels. This said, that doesn't mean that there is not parallel procedures or parallel initiatives ongoing in Brussels. And I would like to point out to two of them which are important in the context of this global license or in general of the discussions how to remunerate artists in an adequate way and at the same time giving the freedom to consumers and users to freely share information on the internet or content on the internet. The one is a development which has to do with collective societies. The Commission had was concerned how to manage online rights in the internet, how those could be managed. One of the problems they saw is that the existing collecting societies are national monopolies. There are about 65 collecting societies in Europe, and the Commission was of the opinion that that is way too much to have a good uptake of online music. So they were concerned to foster the online music. Last year, in October 2005, they came up with a recommendation, which is a non-binding law, with some principles how these collecting societies should look like. The basic feature, I would say, is it gives the right holders the freedom to choose the collecting society they want to give the rights to be managed. And this without territorial boundaries. The problem from a consumer perspective, and I don't want to go into detail of this recommendation, which is at the moment discussed in the European Parliament because they were very mad about being bypassed by the Commission through this recommendation. This main feature is at the end negative for consumers. The Commission itself, in an underlying study, pointed out that this will create fewer collecting societies, giving them more power vis-a-vis commercial users, and in particular, premium content will the prices of premium content will rise. I found personally that this was a quite astonishing statement, bluntly to state that the consumers will have negative effects of this new structure of collecting societies. What eventually could happen with such a system would be that the majors could create their own collecting rights management societies. Commercial users would, in order to get the license, have to go to the collecting society, which manages the catalog they want. They would then get a pan-European license. But the problem about it would be that they probably would not so much care about fewer, not so popular catalogs, because they would have to go to another collecting society, for example, a national one or a genre one, which is managing those rights, because it would not be cost efficient for them. Now, for the consumer at the same time, that would mean if, for example, you do have an iPod and iTunes would not have this catalog, they would have to buy another player to get the same from a different service provider. So this was not entirely thought through. By no means did it mention anything of the global license. Another initiative which is forthcoming in this respect is most likely also a recommendation, I do not know yet, on levies and digital rights management. Here, the Copyright Directive, which has basically introduced the DRM, also stated with when DRM is applied, levies should be phased out. So you all know since DRM is applied in the market, deployed in the market, we have seen at the same time a rise in levies. So this is not coherent. The Commission realizes that and is planning to do something about it, what we will have to see in the coming month. But in principle, it favors DRM. So both of those initiatives definitely rather support per-use business models based on licensing systems, which would not cover anything which has to do with a compulsory license or this sort of flat rate. This is in particular interesting because it seems to me that it is not really economically based. Now, if you think about other sectors, for example, telephony, where you had years ago a system based on per unit, more and more this shifts to flat rate subscriptions, just because the amount of control, the costs of control of this per-use based business models are too high. So in order to, the costs would just not be efficient to control that anymore. So what they do, they shift to flat rates. And I think the same has to be applied in the music online system. Unfortunately, If you see all the other initiatives ongoing in Brussels, you will see that they are not far away from even thinking about that. There is at the same time initiatives which will force ISPs to cooperate with the big music business or the big film business to basically deal with, I would say, minor user infringements of copyright. There will be next year a review of the e-commerce directive, which at the moment still gives some leeway to ISPs in respect to ISP liability of infringing issues. There is at the same time a new proposal in the parliament on criminal measures let's say, enforcement of intellectual property right, where even definitions like commercial use are missing, so where consumers do run a risk to be criminalized by this law when they, in when they engage in file sharing activities. All this said is basically putting together a picture where you can definitely see that the Commission does still the European institutions rather go in a direction per pay-per-use business models with a high amount of control, be it by fostering DRM or be it by prosecution. An interesting aspect eventually should be mentioned also that the industry is clever enough to shift to criminal sanctions from civil sanctions, because this will lower their own costs considerably, because obviously if you do have criminal prosecution, the cost is on the public, while if you have civil lawsuits, the cost will remain on those who sue. So this is a clever aspect of this control issue. Now, this said, both those recommendations and all these other mentioned initiatives are out there, and we have, as a consumer organization who operates in Brussels, we have not been successful in bringing the flat rate proposal into the debate, and I will quickly point out why. That is what Volker basically mentioned in we are not very clear where we stand. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, we are representing around 40 consumer organizations in almost 30 European countries, all of the member states, obviously. And not in all countries do exist levy systems, like in the UK and in Ireland. They do not know levies. Unfortunately, they also do not know private copy, which is ridiculous nowadays, because obviously, like, there has been a recent survey that around 80% of the population do private copies. So they constantly, every day, every single day, infringe copyright law. But still, in order to propose such a system, you need to be familiar with levies, and there needs to be some more work to be done to introduce that. But more importantly than that, but Volker wanted to have a more exposition, is that the Commission and the European Parliament and the Council will openly discuss this flat rate. Now, I would also like just to finish to say, I wish to say something about Bernard Linkhoff's proposal, which is difficult because it was so complex. What I just heard, I was a bit afraid when I heard all this. There was a new right. I'm not sure whether I understood all the others diminished or, but new rights is something which is at the moment where we have this development in technology, something where legislators should step back and wait what's happening here. So I would be happy to discuss more, and eventually we will understand more what he meant by that. So if you have any further questions later on or so, the consumer organization has also a website on digital rights. We are working very hard on that, which you can visit, and write me emails if you have questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cornelia, for this perspective from Brussels, which is not very hopeful. I mean, not for people promoting this system. The forces that are not interested in such a levy system seem to be very powerful, although the arguments are so compelling. I mean, all the fairness arguments that we heard on this panel, the comparison, Cornelia, that you drew, that even regular business models shift by themselves for very business rationale reasons, as in telephony, from per unit based payment to flat rates. My feeling is we have a hell of a lot of good arguments. How do we get them across? How do we make this happen? And I would like to have, we have about 20 minutes left for a bit of discussion, but first I would like to have a last brief round of statements, maybe beginning from the perspective in France, where we're closest to making this a reality. What do we need to do to make this happen? What are your ideas on this, please?
What do we need to do to make it happen in France?
Everywhere. On the planet.
About the global license?
Let's start in France.
About the global license? Wow. First, a revolution. Because in France, you understood that all the guys from the industry, they think that they are always in a post-industrial age. We are in digital age. So we've got an era more than them. So there is a misunderstanding with the aim of what is going on the internet. They have to understand, and now they understood because last days some guys from SACEM or even majors and even Stéphane Bourdoiseau, who is the boss of Wagram, said that the global license was a good idea because Universal pilots all the propaganda against the global license. And he wanted DRM, he wanted repression, he wanted all the stuff to let him do what he's doing now. To put free 50% of the, and after 100% of his catalog on internet. So I think, I hope that some big artists will decide to get out of this this system. To give the example, so and the global license, I think that it's if at the next election for the presidency, Socialist Party or left side has got will win, I think that we will return on the idea of the global license. But I hope that it will be not a dream, but it's a. We've got a chance to put it in France.
Very good.
In answer to your question, just by the way, what I was proposing is not an additional right, but rather a substitute right, so that there would not be further compensation on top of what's already paid and further rights to clear, but a single right that would be most easily cleared and most easily compensated, and the money flowing down to those who really contributed to the artistic product. In answer to your question, I think what we need to do is form coalitions between consumers, those who are really concerned directly and who stand in opposition to the established labels and music publishers, which would include groups such as consumers, obviously, but also consumer electronics makers who would like to be able to meet consumer demand and thus make their new fortunes, technology firms, individual artists, independent labels, and independent music publishers who all stand in opposition, perhaps and hopefully, to the existing structure. And those coalitions lobby the appropriate legislative bodies, and see what can be achieved. And of course, making as big a public display of new ideas as is possible, and spreading new ideas as widely as possible, which is the way, of course, you attract attention to them and so support, and you develop a political groundswell.
With the Alliance and the Paris Accord, We're on the way to building these coalitions already. Peter?
Hello. I'm actually quite optimistic at the moment, but maybe that's just because I'm a sort of stupid sort of guy. I think that the independent labels, as represented by Impala, are certainly on board with the idea of some sort of blanket licensing. They've already proposed their value recognition right, which I think is halfway there. And the people involved in that were the British Music Rights, which is all the music publishers and the authors and composers, also included the Music Managers Forum and included the Musicians Union. So it was an extremely broad coalition. They're in discussions with the major labels in the UK, who are also at least pretending to be sympathetic. I have a good deal of skepticism about whether they will really be sympathetic. They'll be waiting to get their orders from America. And on that front, I have various informations that that Universal, who is by far the biggest label, has some serious doubts as to whether the present mode of action that they've adopted makes sense. And I think there is a huge movement going on. So I'm actually quite optimistic. I think we've got to get the artists on board. I think we've done really badly at getting the artists on board, because I think the artists, by and large, like to get their music out. And as long as we can assure them that there's going to be as much money sloshing around as there has been before, I think that we can probably keep the musicians on board. But I think that's going to be a big issue, is to get the musicians on the medium to top level. I think the entry-level musicians are obviously on board. They see that as the only way in, and being an invaluable thing. What I'm surprised is how behind the game the EU seems to be. I mean, I think they're classically going to start trying to legislate for 1990 in 2007. And I think that the great thing that the you lot can do is, number one, is hack every DRM system that comes up and destroy it as quickly as you have done up to date. And you've done a fantastic job between you all out there all around the world. I think in the end, bad law tends to get discarded, and the reality of people's behavior, it may not lead to the change in the law, but it may lead to everyone forgetting about the law. And I think that's the one positive thing about it becoming a criminal offense. Will the police be willing to take to court the children of the judges?
So there's quite a bit of optimism here. Cornelia, you're in the trenches in the daily work.
You're more realistic, Cornelia.
I don't know.
No, I mean, it's not
okay,
about...
Okay, I will say something very pessimistic, and then I try to be a bit more optimistic. The first thing is just what you just said under this new proposal to enforce infringement of copyright. You would yourself commit a crime by inciting others to infringe copyright.
And if they took me to court, it would be fantastic. I mean, because they would look such fools. It would polarize the situation. I mean, that's exactly what I mean.
True. Now, from a very practical view, I think what consumers can do is, I think that consumers are also voters. That is the way to pressure politicians. I think the example of Sweden shows that this can work in Sweden when this file-sharing Pirate Bay was shut down. There was a demonstration. There is soon elections, and there is a proposal to legalize this. So pressure from consumers as voters is certainly the easiest way to go through. Much harder on a European level, of course, but to convince, for example, consumer organizations of such a solution, that is to go and talk to them on a national level. all I can say at the moment.
All right, thank you.
Rasmus Fleischer, on the first day, one of the Pirat Piran people in Sweden was rather critical about this levy system. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing him now, but he also did raise a number of questions that we will have to address, but not now, but on Sunday. The Paris Accord, what will it do to bring this model forward?
The who?
The Paris Accord?
Yes, well, yes. Well, I'd like to focus on the issue of the politics of these discussions. We had a meeting with a member of the European Commission staff, a fairly high official, and she told us she thought it was important for us to make the debates on intellectual property issues more political.
Yes.
She said there was a tendency to think of these things as technical issues. And that drove away people that couldn't really feel confident they could go toe-to-toe on this and that aspect of arcane copyright law or technological standards issues or things like that. So I said, I think that was good advice in order to sort of tell people, really, this is a political conversation that's taking place right now. And, you know, the details can be worked out by the technical people, but first you have to figure out kind of the basic contours of where you want to go, I think. And I think that's part of this sort of thing. Now, we had thought that the key would be to focus on one test case somewhere on the planet where you could then make the paradigm shift and see what it looked like for artists and so you could kind of, and consumers, and you could sort of see the benefits and the impact on livelihoods is, you know, in the one test case. We had initially thought the place to look for would be some country that had a lot of bandwidth and did not have a strong politically influential sort of publishing / distribution industry. I mean, they had artists, but not necessarily the people that can control the distribution and aggregation of works. So we were thinking, you know, where maybe Northern Europe or Korea, or, you know, we weren't quite sure what, you know, where you'd look for that kind of thing. I'm not sure that's, Terry Fisher seems to be mildly optimistic about China. I'm not really sure. Yeah, okay. So there's different places, but sometimes you're surprised by things like who would have thought that the French would have gone as far as they did. I mean, I would have thought that would be the last country to have done it, and there it was. And so I think sometimes these things happen because a small number of people show extraordinary leadership, and they just touch a public nerve, and things just take off. And so I think, you know, some of these things are somewhat unpredictable. Now, one thing that we thought is important is to have events that focus on doomsday scenarios around DRM technology. And we had in mind two different doomsday scenarios. One is that DRM works, and what would be the result in the world of 100% effective DRM technologies? And just to sort of trace that out and think about it, not only for music, but the collateral effect of applying these technologies in education markets and scientific information, and communications between bosses and the workers and government documents, the basic instruments of democracy. If you could actually, the Chinese government, if the U.S. government, if everybody could control every document, every move of every document, meter, monitor, control, and restrict access to everything, would we have ever seen the photographs of Abu Ghraib in Iraq? I mean, you know, there's a lot of scenarios about the complete and total control of information, which are rather scary. So that's sort of one doomsday scenario. A different doomsday scenario is DRM doesn't work, and that is the cost of storage fall, and you can walk around with a memory stick that has 50 years of recorded music in it and just put it in somebody's you know, iPod 10 years from now, and just, you know, what would that be like for the recording industry if there's sort of an underground annihilation of that model? So both those scenarios make both sides realize that there's something to gain from exploring the non-police state solutions to this problem. I think that's helpful in getting people motivated to why this is kind of an important thing. Another Another thing that I think has been important progress is if you go back a few years ago, we were trying to promote the idea of a compulsory license approach when Napster was really important. And a lot of groups like EFF and everybody was opposed to the idea of the compulsory license. And there was a lot of this focus on, you know, selling the T-shirts and that kind of stuff. And I think we're past that. And I think that's a new sign of maturity in this conversation, is that now people realize that that you're not going to replace a revenue stream with nothing. That, you know, with the idea that somehow there's some kind of fairy dust somewhere from being famous that's going to somehow fix everything. That I think what happened in France, what Volcker's been working on, and I think that what EFF's position now, I think things have really changed a lot. So I think that makes it easier. But I think the public maybe is not really aware that it's gone from this sort of, like, there is no such thing as piracy mode to this new idea that we want to find a different way of thinking about, you know, the relationship between creative communities and consumers and how people make livings. I think the conversations have advanced faster than the public relations about the conversations, partly because the propaganda campaign is always piracy this, piracy that, you know, it's sort of so strong, it's kind of hard to get a word in edgewise sometimes to kind of elevate the debate. Now, the French thing helped that quite a bit because it was clear that that was a different kind of a proposal. And I think that's really important. Also, I think on DRM, there's a conversation about DRM light versus DRM, you know, that implies access controls. That is implicit in what some of the proposals we heard today, and Terry Fisher's work, I think, too. Some people are proposing technologies that report usage of information in the music area, but don't restrict copying. And the long tail sort of motivates these discussions because they're not happy with the sampling kind of paradigms and things like that. It's a little scary because of the privacy issues, and I think it's tolerable in the area of music to some extent, but kind of scary when it sort of migrates out of music into other types of content. So I think this is an area that requires some debate and conversation because it's an important topic, and I don't think people have focused enough on these sort of different paradigms of what, I mean, sometimes I think of the GNU public license as a form of digital rights management because it's a way of telling people what you can do with a piece of software. But I think people now think of DRM TPMs, you know, in Europe, maybe everyone but me, I don't know, is a way of stopping you from doing, physically stopping you from copying documents and reporting your activities and things like that. So that's something. Another technical issue is some of the proposals have this idea that there's kind of a global budget that the artists get, like you mentioned the $5 a person or something like that per month, which I find appealing because then on the margin, really usage is free on the margin. So it encourages people to repurpose, remix, to sort of create new kind of works that are kind of these kind of things without sort of thinking that every new use of an instrument is necessarily something you have to pay for. But sometimes I hear people in the industry sometimes say, yeah, but, you know, like maybe where we add in terms of fraction of the GDP for us is not where we want to be, you know, and that's something you have to sort of talk that through so you understand and looking at some historical data to kind of, because one thing the marketplace does for better or for worse is it sort of changes all the time, you know, how much of the, you know, the national income goes to this, that, or the other sector. I see this in pharmaceuticals where it's risen and the pharmaceutical sector probably sort of thinks that the exclusive rights allows them to just keep a bigger and bigger fraction of GDP, you know, but, you know, that's something people kind of have to think about. But I'll conclude, but I will say that I think the idea we have of this Paris Accord conversation, I would hope that we could try and wind up this negotiation by next June, like sort of the anniversary, maybe the first meeting, and we could see if we could actually establish in these various areas and sign up some people that at least moved us in the direction of a common platform that we could use to better educate. The problem of 35 different proposals is that, you know, it's hard to kind of get people to understand that there's some kind of something important coalescing. So if we can get people to collaborate, work together, and at least find the areas that are sort of strong enough areas of consensus to present it, I think that makes it easier and more authoritative to go. I think, though, that what the French have done has been so important because that actually gave so much more legitimacy to a lot of these conversations. I just think we all really owe a debt to the people that worked on that.
So we're way over time already, but I have signals from Peter and Bennett to reply to this. Yes, I see two, three. I'm afraid that's we will have to make a choice.
But what is it, Philip? You have to go
to the consumer over us.
Okay. Andrea, please, and then please come up to the microphone, and then the two of you can have a last word, but not many more words, please. No? It would be a pity, yes. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Hello, I'm Andrea Glorioso from the Polytechnic of Torino in Italy. Just a quick comment on what Jamie Love has said, that some people refer to the GNU General Public License or any other kind of copyright license as a kind of digital rights management because it tells people what to do or what not to do. I think it's useful to focus the debate. And I'm not in this moment pro or contra DRM per se, but it's very useful to focus the debate. From this point of view, even the Italian Constitution is digital rights management because it tells people what they should or shouldn't do in the digital space. But we believe, the general understanding is that digital rights management is something much more specific that is more related to how rights are enforced rather than how rights are described. And the problem, there is one author whose name I can't remember, unfortunately, that gave a wonderful definition of what digital rights management is. It is a judge on a chip, a judge on a microchip. It decides what you should or what you shouldn't do, but the problem is that the chip will never have a microchip, will never have the same degree of understanding, of contextual understanding, given current technology, of what the situation is. And this is the problem with current digital rights management that maybe will be solved, maybe not, but I think it's very useful to avoid referring to copyright licenses or other kind of laws as we have today as digital rights management. Thank you.
Okay, Philip, please. Very quickly.
Just one precision on the French situation and then one comment on what I believe is a key underlying issue. The French situation was actually the produce of the join of two separate movements. One was the movement for the global license, but the other one was a mass movement against DRM. Where 150,000 people signed a petition which did not refer to the global license, had nothing to do, was just saying there are levels of protection of DRM that are unacceptable. And so these two movements, instead of opposing each other, actually reinforced each other because the existence of the anti-DRM movement pushed MPs towards trying to find ways to go around the problem rather than have to face it frontally. That's why I thank Peter for his commitment to support the anti-DRM movement. Now, on the substance, I think one of the I like Larry's idea of persuasion being the most important thing, even if we know that this is not the only thing that happens in the world. I mean, it's clear that the EC, it's not because they don't know that they are doing what they are doing. I mean, I can tell you, I was there for 7 years looking at all the preparation for this particular directive and the next ones. They know perfectly, simply they are working for a vision of a world, and this vision of a world is a vision of not a read-only, but a supply-only society. And here we have a strong opposition
between everyone is a supplier, everyone is a distributor, even if it is not yet, everyone is a creator, but we have a strong opposition. And there, so if we go want to go further than that, we need to look at things, we need to change our vocabulary. I mean, don't speak about compensate. I'm an author, I'm not a musician, I'm a voter, I don't need to be compensated when people read my books. Rewarded, if they wish, yes, I'm happy with that. Mm-hmm. And but deeper than that, there is the notion we must change our way of speaking, of thinking with regard to markets. I mean, there is an implicit idea, which is actually part of what Joe Stiglitz calls market fanaticism, is to consider that only markets that are based on individual decisions, on individual sales remunerated by individual payments, would be markets, and that aggregate ways to buy a set of rights would not. This is completely wrong. I mean, the market economy would simply not exist without this aggregation mechanism. That's why, though I think enormously Bennett for presenting his ideas here, I think there are two elements on which I hope he goes a step further. The one element is about individual licensing of individual works will never work, and the result is it will work extremely against cultural diversity. Because if you are to consider a choice of buying something when you want to promote an unknown artist whose standing you do not know, then you will simply not do it. So if we want the system to work for cultural diversity, we really need that it is a blanket system. And the second thing is, I'm sorry, but I'm a software specialist and I'm a mathematician, and I tell you there is no problem at all to measure by sampling and other techniques in the information sphere. Sampling does not work in the old economy of contents, but it works perfectly in the information sphere, and it works even better because people have an incentive to make their usage, in particular upload usage, known. You know, someone who uploads legally contents from an artist has an interest for that artist to be remunerated. Does not cost anything to that person, and if they upload it, it's because they like it. So they want to please. So I believe there really a global licensing scheme is good, and the search for perfect justice kills justice there. That led me, for example, to support compulsory legal license, which I believe are perfectly in accordance with treaties, and rather than optional, because it gives a very strong political power when you can say, okay, there are 10 million broadband subscribers, it will bring that much amount of money. I'm persuaded that even an optional license would bring lots of money, but you cannot prove it. While a compulsory one, you know it, and if you want to do social exemptions for low income, it is of course more than fine.
Thank you, Philip. Bennett, you were addressed directly, and then Peter to go last, then we really have to finish this up. Thank you.
Regarding compulsory licensing, and Jamie's comment on it, I long supported compulsory licenses, and I'm convinced after years that it is an absolute political non-starter, which is, and unless it's initiated by the music industry itself, such as the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the recent statutory license proposals for server-end copies. That's what drove me to this quasi-joint works treatment of musical works and sound recordings. The other thing that to respond to you is on the privacy issue involved with a census or even with samples, you have to still have an ability to audit whatever the sample or the census is going to be so that the recipient of the royalties will know that they received what they really should have received. The privacy issue can be solved, I think, first, if you only have a single collective and personally identifying information gets out, you know exactly who to blame for allowing it to get out. And second of all, we should have protections of a civil and perhaps even of a criminal nature with penalties of that sort, equivalent to what in the United States we have under the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. As severe as they possibly can be, with the greatest possible restrictions and limitations on the use of private information, and with severe penalties in case the information gets out. Thank you.
Peter,
my turn.
To the last. We really have to wrap this up.
You get the last word. You've got the first. You get the last. Philippe, thank you very much. I think tomorrow, I really hope a lot of you are going to come tomorrow to the Humboldt, because I think we're just starting. I just wanted to say three quick things. Number one, things don't have to be free, they have to feel free. And economically, this gives you an incredible potential, because you're talking about, it starts to make sense economically in terms of the marginal cost. Very fundamental economic argument, which I think can be understood even by the EU. Number two is, I think that the way of pressurizing the record companies, and who are undoubtedly leading the charge against all this movement, though I think they're weakening, is to explain to the investors. The investors don't care about the business model. They only care about the profits. So probably where a lot of our conversation should be is with the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, and those sorts of people, rather than directly with the industry. Because I think the models we're talking about gives the record companies very good profit potential. It gets rid of a lot of their stupid expenditures as well. Finally, I think the thing which hasn't been raised at all, which I'm going to say nothing other than because we'll talk about it tomorrow, is I think a very interesting is to think about remuneration rights rather than exclusive rights, which we have already in neighbouring rights. And I think that that becomes a very, very interesting notion in all sorts of ways. I haven't thought them all through. I don't think anyone has, but it's there, and I hope we'll talk about it tomorrow.
Well, thank you all for participating, listening, and please give a big hand to our panelists.